Yet when she had gained the great road out of Hambry, and her heart had demanded she run, she had run. Under the light of the kissing moon, and with her skirt held above her knees, she had galloped like a pony, with her shadow galloping right beside her. For a mile or more she had run, until every muscle in her body tingled, and the air she pulled down her throat tasted like some sweet, heated liquid. And when she reached the upland track leading to this high sinister, she had sung, because her heart demanded it. And, she supposed, it really hadn't been such a bad idea. If nothing else, it had kept the worst of her megrims away. Singing was good for that much, anyway. Now she walked to the end of the path, singing the chorus of Careless Love. As she stepped into the scant light which fell through the open door and onto the stoop, a harsh raincrow voice spoke from the shadows.
"Stop your howling, missy. It catches in my brains like a fish hook."
Susan, who had been told all her life that she had a fair singing voice, a gift from her grandma, no doubt, fell silent at once, abashed. She stood on the stoop with her hands clasped in front of her apron. Beneath the apron, she wore her second-best dress. She only had two. Beneath it, her heart was thumping, very hard. A cat, a hideous thing with two extra legs sticking out of its sides like toasting forks, came into the doorway first. It looked up at her, seemed to measure her, then screwed its face up in a look that was eerily human, contempt. It hissed at her, then flashed away into the night. "Well, good evening to you, too," Susan thought. The old woman she had been sent to see stepped into the doorway. She looked Susan up and down with that same expression of flat-eyed contempt, then stood back.
"Come in, and mind you clap the door tight. The wind has a way of blowing it open, as you see."
Susan stepped inside. She didn't want to close herself into this bad-smelling room with the old woman, but when there was no choice, hesitation was ever a fault. So her father had said, whether the matter under discussion was sums and subtractions, or how to deal with boys at barn dances when their hands became overly adventurous. She pulled the door firmly to and heard it latch.
"And here you are,"
the old woman said, and offered a grotesque smile of welcome. It was a smile guaranteed to make even a brave girl think of stories told in the nursery, winter's tales of old women with snaggled teeth and bubbling cauldrons full of toad-green liquid. There was no cauldron over the fire in this room, nor was the fire itself much of a shake, in Susan's opinion. But the girl guessed there had been, betimes, and things in it of which it might be better not to think. That this woman was a real witch and not just an old lady posing as one was something Susan had felt sure of from the moment she had seen Rhea darting back inside her hut with the malformed cat at her heels. It was something you could almost smell, like the reeky aroma rising off the hag's skin. "Yes," she said, smiling. She tried to make it a good one, bright and unafraid. "Here I am."
"And it's early yar, my little sweeting, early yar."
"I ran part way. The moon got into my blood, I suppose. That's what my dad would have said."
The old woman's horrible smile widened into something that made Susan think of the way eels sometimes seem to grin, after death and just before the pot.
"Aye, but dead he is, dead these 5 years, Pat Delgado of the red hair and beard, the life mashed out of him by his own horse, aye, and went into the clearing at the end of the path with the music of his own snapping bones in his ears, so he did."
The nervous smile slipped from Susan's face as if slapped away. She felt tears, always close at the mere mention of her dad's name, burn at the back of her eyes, but she would not let them fall, not in this heartless old crow's sight, she wouldn't.
"Let our business be quick and be done,"
she said in a dry voice that was far from her usual one. That voice was usually cheery and merry and ready for fun. But she was Pat Delgado's child, daughter of the best drover ever to work the Western Drop, and she remembered his face very well. She could rise to a stronger nature if required, as it now clearly was. The old woman had meant to reach out and scratch as deep as she could, and the more she saw that her efforts were succeeding, the more she would redouble them. The hag, meanwhile, was watching Susan shrewdly, her bunch-knuckled hands planted on her hips while her cap twined around her ankles. Her eyes were rheumy, but Susan saw enough of them to realize they were the same gray-green shade as the cat's eyes, and to wonder what sort of fell magic that might be. She felt an urge, a strong one, to drop her eyes, and would not. It was all right to feel fear, but sometimes a very bad idea to show it.
"You look at me pert, missy," Rhea said at last.
Her smile was dissolving slowly into a petulant frown.
"Nay, old mother," Susan replied evenly, "only as one who wishes to do the business she came for and be gone. I have come here at the wish of my Lord Mayor of Magus, and at that of my Aunt Cordelia, sister of my father, my dear father, of whom I would hear no ill spoken."
"I speak as I do," the old woman said.
The words were dismissive, yet there was a trace of fawning servility in the hag's voice. Susan set no importance on that. It was a tone such a thing as this had probably adopted her whole life, and came as automatically as breath.
"I've lived alone a long time, with no mistress but myself, and once it begins, my tongue goes where it will."
"Then sometimes it might be best not to let it begin at all."
The old woman's eyes flashed uglily.
"Curb your own, stripling girl, lest you find it dead in your mouth, where it will rot and make the mayor think twice about kissing you when he smells its stink. Aye, even under such a moon as this."
Susan's heart filled with misery and bewilderment. She'd come up here intent on only one thing, getting the business done as quickly as possible, a barely explained rite that was apt to be painful and sure to be shameful. Now this old woman was looking at her with flat and naked hatred. How could things have gone wrong with such suddenness? Or was it always this way with witches?
"We have begun badly, mistress. Can we start over?"
Susan asked suddenly, and held out her hand. The hag looked startled, although she did reach out and make brief contact, the wrinkled tips of her fingers touching the short-nailed fingers of the 16-year-old girl who stood before her, with her clear-skinned face shining and her long hair braided down her back. Susan had to make a real effort not to grimace at the touch, brief as it was. The old woman's fingers were as chilly as those of a corpse. But Susan had touched chilly fingers before. "Cold hands, warm heart," Aunt Cord sometimes said. The real unpleasantness was in the texture, the feel of cold flesh, spongy and loose on the bones, as if the woman to whom they were attached had drowned and lain long in some pool.
Nay, there's no starting over," the old woman said. "Yet mayhap we'll go on better than we've begun. You've a powerful friend in the mayor, and I'd not have him for my enemy."
She's honest, at least, Susan thought,
then had to laugh at herself. This woman would be honest only when she absolutely had to be. Left to her own devices and desires, she'd lie about everything. The weather, the crops, the flights of birds come reaping.
"He came before I expected ye, and it's put me out of temper, so it has. Have ye brought me something, missy? Ye have, I'll warrant."
Her eyes were glittering once more, this time not with anger. Susan reached beneath her apron, so stupid, wearing an apron for an errand on the backside of nowhere, but it was what custom demanded, and into her pocket. There, tied to a string so it could not be easily lost, by a young girl suddenly moved to run in the moonlight, perchance, was a cloth bag. Susan broke the binding string and brought the bag out. She put it in the outstretched hand before her, the palm so worn that the lines marking it were now little more than ghosts. She was careful not to touch Rhea again, although the old woman would be touching her again, and soon.
"Is it the sound of the wind makes ye shiver?"
Rhea asked. Although Susan could tell her mind was mostly fixed on the little bag, her fingers were busy tugging out the knot in the drawstring.
"Yes, the wind."
"And so it should. 'Tis the voices of the dead you hear in the wind, and when they scream so, 'tis because they regret—"
The knot gave. She loosened the drawstring and tumbled 2 gold coins into her hand. They were unevenly milled and crude, no one had made such for generations, but they were heavy, and the eagles engraved upon them had a certain power. Rhea lifted one to her mouth, pulled back her lips to reveal a few gruesome teeth, and bit down. The hag looked at the faint indentations her teeth had left in the gold. For several seconds she gazed, rapt, then closed her fingers over them tightly. While Rhea's attention was distracted by the coins, Susan happened to look through the open door to her left and into what she assumed was the witch's bedchamber. And here she saw an odd and disquieting thing. A light under the bed. A pink, pulsing light. It seemed to be coming from some kind of box, although she could not quite... The witch looked up, and Susan hastily moved her eyes to a corner of the room, where a net containing 3 or 4 strange white fruits hung from a hook. Then, as the old woman moved and her huge shadow danced ponderously away from that part of the wall, Susan saw they were not fruits at all, but skulls. She felt a sickish drop in her stomach.
"The fire needs building up, missy. Go around to the side of the house and bring back an armload of wood. Good-sized sticks are what's wanted, and never mind whining you can't lug 'em. You're of a strapping good size, so you are."
Susan, who had quit whining about chores around the time she had quit pissing into her clouts, said nothing. Although it did cross her mind to ask Rhea if everyone who brought her gold was invited to lug her wood. In truth, she didn't mind. The air outside would taste like wine after the stench of the hut. She had almost reached the door when her foot struck something hot and yielding. The cat yowled. Susan stumbled and almost fell. From behind her, the old woman issued a series of gasping, choking sounds, which Susan eventually recognized as laughter.
"Watch Musty, my little sweet one. Tricksy he is, and tripsy as well, betimes, so he is.
And off she went in another gale. The cat looked up at Susan, its ears laid back, its gray-green eyes wide. It hissed at her, and Susan, unaware she was going to do it until it was done, hissed back. Like its expression of contempt, Musty's look of surprise was eerily, and in this case comically, human. It turned and fled for Rhea's bedroom, its split tail lashing. Susan opened the door and went outside to get the wood. Already she felt as if she had been here 1,000 years, and that it might be 1,000 more before she could go home. 4. The air was as sweet as she had hoped. Perhaps even sweeter. And for a moment she only stood on the stoop, breathing it in, trying to cleanse her lungs and her mind. After 5 good breaths, she got herself in motion. Around the side of the house she went. But it was the wrong side, it seemed, for there was no woodpile here. There was a narrow excuse for a window, however, half buried in some tough and unlovely creeper. It was toward the back of the hut, and must look in on the old woman's sleeping closet. "Don't look in there. Whatever she's got under her bed isn't your business, and if she were to catch you..." She went to the window despite these admonitions and peeked in. It was unlikely that Rhea would have seen Susan's face through the dense overgrowth of pig ivy, even if the old besom had been looking in that direction, and she wasn't. She was on her knees, the drawstring bag caught in her teeth, reaching under the bed. She brought out a box and opened its lid, which was already ajar. Her face was flooded with soft pink radiance, and Susan gasped. For one moment it was the face of a young girl, but one filled with cruelty as well as youth, the face of a self-willed child determined to learn all the wrong things for all the wrong reasons. The face of the girl this hag once had been, mayhap. The light appeared to be coming from some sort of glass ball. The old woman looked at it for several moments, her eyes wide and fascinated. Her lips moved as if she were speaking to it, or perhaps even singing to it. The little bag Susan had brought from town, its strings still clamped in the hag's mouth, bobbed up and down as she spoke. Then, with what appeared to be great effort of will, she closed the box, cutting off the rosy light. Susan found herself relieved. There was something about it she didn't like. The old woman cupped one hand over the silver lock in the middle of the lid, and a brief scarlet light spiked out from between her fingers. All this with the drawstring bag still hanging from her mouth. Then she put the box on the bed, knelt, and began running her hands over the dirt just beneath the bed's edge. Although she touched only with her palms, lines appeared as if she had used a drawing tool. These lines darkened, becoming what looked like grooves. "The wood, Susan! Get the wood before she wakes up to how long you've been gone, for your father's sake!" Susan pulled the skirt of her dress all the way up to her waist. She did not want the old woman to see dirt or leaves on her clothing when she came back inside, did not want to answer the questions the sight of such smuts might provoke, and crawled beneath the window with her white cotton drawers flashing in the moonlight. Once she was past, she got to her feet again and hurried quietly around to the far side of the hut. Here she found the woodpile under an old, moldy-smelling hide. She took half a dozen good-sized chunks and walked back toward the front of the house with them in her arms. When she entered, turning sideways to get her load through the doorway without dropping any, the old woman was back in the main room, staring moodily into the fireplace, where there was now little more than embers. Of the drawstring bag, there was no sign.
"Took you long enough, missy," Rhea said.
She continued to look into the fireplace as if Susan were of no account, but one foot tapped below the dirty hem of her dress, and her eyebrows were drawn together. Susan crossed the room, peering over the load of wood in her arms as well as she could while she walked. It wouldn't surprise her a bit to spy the cat lurking near, hoping to trip her up.
"I saw a spider," she said. "I flapped my apron at it to make it run away. I hate the look of 'em, so I do."
"You'll see something you like the look of even less soon enough," Rhea said, grinning her peculiar one-sided grin. "Out of old Thorin's nightshirt it'll come, stiff as a stick and red as rhubarb. Hold a minute, girl, ye gods. You've brought enough for a fair day bonfire."
Rhea took two fat logs from Susan's pile and tossed them indifferently onto the coals. Embers spiraled up the dark and faintly roaring shaft of the chimney.
"There, you've scattered what's left of your fire, you silly old thing, and we'll likely have to rekindle the whole mess," Susan thought.
Then Rhea reached into the fireplace with one splayed hand, spoke a guttural word, and the logs blazed up as if soaked in oil.
"Put the rest over there," she said, pointing at the wood box. "And mind you not be a scatterbug, missy."
What, and dirty, all this neat? Susan thought.
She bit the insides of her cheeks to kill the smile that wanted to rise on her mouth. Rhea might have sensed it, however. When Susan straightened again, the old woman was looking at her with a doer, knowing expression.
"All right, mistress. Let's do our business and have it done. Do you know why you're here?"
"I am here at Mayor Thorin's wish," Susan repeated, knowing that was no real answer.
She was frightened now, more frightened than when she had looked through the window and seen the old woman crooning to the glass ball.
"His wife has come barren to the end of her courses. He wishes to have a son before he is also unable to..."
"Pish tush! Spare me the codswallop and pretty words. He wants tits and ass that don't squish in his hands, and a box that'll grip what he pushes. If he's still man enough to push it, that is. If a son come of it, aye, fine, he'll give it over to you to keep and raise until it's old enough to school, and after that you'll see it no more. If it's a daughter, he'll likely take it from you and give it to his new man, the one with the girl's hair and the limp, to drown in the nearest cattle walla."
Susan stared at her, shocked out of all measure. The old woman saw the look and laughed.
"Don't like the sound of the truth, do yer? Few do, missy. But that's neither here nor there. Your auntie was ever a trig one, and she'll have done all right out of Thorin and Thorin's treasury. What gold you see of it's none of mine, and won't be none of yours either if you don't watch sharp. Take off that dress."
"I won't,"
was what rose to her lips. But what then? To be turned out of this hut, and to be turned out pretty much as she had come, and not as a lizard or a hopping toad, would probably be the best luck she could hope for, and sent west as she was now, without even the two gold coins she'd brought up here?
And that was only the small half of it. The large was that she had given her word. At first she had resisted, but when Aunt Cord had invoked her father's name, she had given in, as she always did. Really, she had no choice. And when there was no choice, hesitation was ever a fault. She brushed the front of her apron, to which small bits of bark now clung, then untied it and took it off. She folded it, laid it on a small, grimy hassock near the hearth, and unbuttoned her dress to the waist. She shivered it from her shoulders and stepped out. She folded it and laid it atop the apron, trying not to mind the greedy way Rhea of Koos was staring at her in the firelight. The cat came sashaying across the floor, grotesque extra legs bobbling, and sat at Rhea's feet. Outside, the wind gusted. It was warm on the hearth, but Susan was cold just the same, as if that wind had gotten inside her somehow.
Hurry, girl, for your father's sake.
Susan pulled her shift over her head, folded it atop the dress, then stood in only her drawers, with her arms folded over her bosom. The fire painted warm orange highlights along her thighs, black circles of shadow in the tender folds behind her knees.
And still she's not naked,
the old crow laughed.
Ain't we, la-dee-da? Aye, we are very fine. Take off those drawers, mistress, and stand as you slid from your mother. Although you had not so many goodies as to interest the likes of Hart Thorin then, did you?
Feeling caught in a nightmare, Susan did as she was bid. With her mound and bush uncovered, her crossed arms seemed foolish. She lowered them to her sides.
No wonder he wants ye,
the old woman said.
"'Tis beautiful yar and true. Is she not, Musty?
The cat wowed.
There's dirt on your knees, Rhea said suddenly. How came it there?
Susan felt a moment of awful panic. She had lifted her skirts to crawl beneath the hag's window and hung herself by doing it. Then an answer rose to her lips, and she spoke it calmly enough. When I came inside of your hut, I grew fearful. I knelt to pray and raised my skirt so as not to soil it.
I'm touched. To want a clean dress for the likes of me. How good you are. Don't you agree, Musty?
The cat wowed, then began to lick one of its forepaws. Get on with it, Susan said. You've been paid, and I'll obey, but stop teasing and have done.
You know what it is I have to do, mistress.
I don't, Susan said. The tears were close again, burning the backs of her eyes, but she would not let them fall. Would not. I have an idea. But when I asked Aunt Cord if I was right, she said that you'd take care of my education in that regard.
Wouldn't dirty her mouth with the words, would she? Well, that's all right. Your Aunt Rhea's not too nice to say what your Aunt Cordelia won't. I'm to make sure that you're physically and spiritually intact, Missy. Proven honesty is what the old ones called it, and it's good enough name, so it is. Step to me.
Susan took two reluctant steps forward so that her bare toes were almost touching the old woman's slippers and her bare breasts were almost touching the old woman's dress.
If a devil or demon has polluted your spirit, such a thing as might taint the child you'll likely bear, it leaves a mark behind. Most often it's a suck mark or a lover's bite, but there's others. Open your mouth.
Susan did, and when the old woman bent closer, the reek of her was so strong that the girl's stomach clenched. She held her breath, praying this would be over soon.
Run out your tongue.
Susan ran out her tongue.
Now send your breezes into my face.
Susan exhaled her held breath. Rhea breathed it in, and then, mercifully, pulled her head away a little. She had been close enough for Susan to see the lice hopping in her hair.
Sweet enough, the old woman said. Good's a meal. Now turn around.
Susan did, and felt the old witch's fingers trail down her back and to her buttocks. Their tips were cold as mud.
Bend over and spread your cheeks, missy. Be not shy. Rhea's seen more than one poultry in her time.
face flushing. She could feel the beat of her heart in the center of her forehead and in the hollows of her temples. Susan did as told. And then she felt one of those corpse-like fingers prod its way into her anus. Susan bit her lips to keep from screaming. The invasion was mercifully short, but there would be another, Susan feared.
Turn around.
She turned. The old woman passed her hands over Susan's breast, flicked lightly at the nipples with her thumbs, then examined the undersides carefully. Rhea slipped a finger into the cup of the girl's navel, then hitched up her own skirt and dropped to her knees with a grunt of effort. She passed her hands down Susan's legs, first front, then back. She seemed to take special pains with the area just below the calves, where the tendons ran.
"Lift your right foot, girl."
Susan did, and uttered a nervous, screamy laugh as Rhea ran a thumbnail down her instep to her heel. The old woman parted her toes, looking between each pair. After this process had been repeated with the other foot, the old woman, still on her knees, said,
"You know what comes next."
"I..."
The word came out of her in a little trembling rush.
"Hold you still, missy. All else is well, clean as a willow strip you are. But now we've come to the cozy nook that's all Thorn cares for. We've come to where honesty must really be proved. So hold you still."
Susan closed her eyes and thought of horses running along the drop. Nominally, they were the barony's horse, overlooked by Reimer, Thorin's chancellor, and the barony's minister of inventory. But the horses didn't know that. They thought they were free. And if you were free in your mind, what else mattered?
"Let me be free in my mind, as free as the horses along the drop. And don't let her hurt me. Please don't let her hurt me. And if she does, please help me to bear it in decent silence."
Cold fingers parted the downy hair below her navel. There was a pause, and then two cold fingers slipped inside her. There was pain, but only a moment of it, and not bad. She'd hurt herself worse, stubbing her toe or barking her shin on the way to the privy in the middle of the night. The humiliation was the bad part, and the revulsion of Rhea's ancient touch.
"Cock tight you are," Rhea cried. "Good as ever was. But Thorn'll see to that, so he will. As for you, my girl, I'll tell you a secret your prissy aunt with her long nose and tight purse and little goosebump tits never knew. Even a girl who's intact don't need to lack for a shiver now and then, if she knows how."
The hag's withdrawing fingers closed gently around the little nubbin of flesh at the head of Susan's cleft. For one terrible second, Susan thought they would pinch that sensitive place, which sometimes made her draw in a breath if it rubbed just so against the pommel of her saddle when she was riding. But instead the fingers caressed, then pressed, and the girl was horrified to feel a heat which was far from unpleasant kindle in her belly.
"Like a little bud of silk,"
the old woman crooned, and her meddling fingers moved faster. Susan felt her hips sway forward, as if with a mind and life of their own, and then she thought of the old woman's greedy, self-willed face, pink as the face of a whore by gaslight as it hung over the open box. She thought of the way the drawstring bag with the gold pieces in it had hung from the wrinkled mouth like some disgorged piece of flesh. And the heat she felt was gone. She drew back, trembling, her arms and belly and breasts breaking out in goose flesh.
"You finished what you were paid to do,"
Susan said. Her voice was dry and harsh. Rhea's face knotted.
"Ye'll not tell me I know, yes, or maybe, impudent stripling of a girl. I know when I'm done. I, Rhea, the weirding of coos.
And be still, and be on your feet before I kick you into the fire, unnatural thing."
The old woman's lips wriggled back from her few remaining teeth in a dog-like sneer. And now, Susan realized, she and the witch-woman were back where they had been at the start, ready to claw each other's eyes out.
Raise hand or foot to me, you impudent cunt, and what leaves my house will leave handless, footless, and blind of eye.
I do not doubt much you could do it, but Thorin should be vexed, Susan said. It was the first time in her life she had ever invoked a man's name for protection. Realizing this made her feel ashamed, small, somehow. She didn't know why that should be, especially since she had agreed to sleep in his bed and bear his child. But it was. The old woman stared, her seamed face working until it folded into a parody of a smile that was worse than her snarl. Puffing and pulling at the arm of her chair, Rhea got to her feet. As she did, Susan quickly began to dress.
Aye, vexed he would be. Perhaps you know best after all, missy. I've had a strange night, and it's wakened parts of me better left asleep. Anything else that might have happened? Take it as a compliment to your youth and purity, and to your beauty as well. Ah, you're a beautiful thing, and there's no doubt in it. Your hair, now, when you let it down, as you will for Thorin, I wot, when you lay with him, it glows like the sun, doesn't it?
Susan did not want to force the old hag out of her posturing, but she didn't want to encourage these fawning compliments either. Not when she could still see the hate in Rhea's rheumy eyes, not when she could feel the old woman's touch still crawling like beetles on her skin. She said nothing, only stepped into her dress, set it on her shoulders, and began to button up the front. Rhea perhaps understood the run of her thoughts, for the smile dropped off her mouth and her manner grew businesslike. Susan found this a great relief.
Well, never mind it. You've proved honest. You may dress yourself and go. But not a word of what passed between us to Thorin, mind ye. Words between women need trouble no man's ear, especially one as great as he.
Yet at this, Rhea could not forbear a certain spasming sneer. Susan didn't know if the old woman was aware of it or not.
Are we agreed?
Anything, just as long as I can be out of here and away. You declare me proved?
Aye, Susan, daughter of Patrick, so I do. But it's not what I say that matters. Now, wait. Somewhere here.
She scrabbled along the mantel, pushing stubs of candles stuck on cracked saucers this way and that, lifting first a kerosene lantern and then a battery flashlight, looking fixedly for a moment at a drawing of a young boy and then putting it aside.
Where are here?
She snatched up a pad of paper with a sooty cover, Sitgo stamped on it in ancient gold letters, and a stub of pencil. She paged almost to the end of the pad before finding a blank sheet. On it she scrawled something, then tore the sheet off the spiral of wire at the top of the pad. She held the sheet out to Susan, who took it and looked at it. Scrawled there was a word she did not understand at first.
Honest.
Below it was a symbol.
What's this?
She asked, tapping the little stick figure drawing.
Rhea, her mark. Known for 6 baronies around, it is, and can't be copied. Show that paper to your aunt, then to Thorin. If your aunt wants to take it and show it to Thorin herself, I know her easy in her bossy ways. Tell her no. Rhea says no. She's not to have the keeping of it.
And if Thorin wants it?
Rhea shrugged dismissively.
Let him keep it, or burn it, or wipe his bum with it, for all of me. It's nothing to you either, for you knew you were honest all along, so you did, true.
Susan nodded. Once, walking home after a dance, she had let a boy slip his hand inside her shirt for a moment or two. But what of that? She was honest, and in more ways than this nasty creature meant.
But don't lose that paper. Unless you'd see me again, that is, and go through the same business a second time.
Gods perish even the thought, Susan thought, and managed not to shudder. She put the paper in her pocket where the drawstring bag had been.
Now come to the door, missy.
She looked as if she wanted to grasp Susan's arm, then thought better of it. The two of them walked side by side to the door, not touching in such a careful way that it made them look awkward. Once there, Rhea did grip Susan's arm. Then, with her other hand, she pointed to the bright silver disk hanging over the top of the coos.
"The kissing moon," Rhea said. "'Tis midsummer."
"Yes."
"Tell Thorin he's not to have you in his bed, or in a haystack, or on the scullery floor, or anywhere else, until Demon Moon rises full in the sky."
"Not until reaping?" That was 3 months. A lifetime, it seemed to her. Susan tried not to show her delight at this reprieve. She'd thought Thorin would put an end to her virginity by moonrise the next night. She wasn't blind to the way he looked at her. Rhea, meanwhile, was looking at the moon, seeming to calculate. Her hand went to the long tail of Susan's hair and stroked it. Susan bore this as well as she could, and just when she felt she could bear it no longer, Rhea dropped her hand back to her side and nodded.
"Aye, not just reaping, but true Findanio, fair knight, tell him. Say that he may have you after the bonfire, you understand?"
"True Findanio, yes." She could barely contain her joy.
"When the fire in Greenheart burns low, and the last of the red-handed men are ashes," Rhea said. "Then, and not until then, you must tell him so."
"I will."
The hand came out and began to stroke her hair again. Susan bore it. After such good news, she thought, it would have been mean-spirited to do otherwise.
"The time between now and reaping you will use to meditate and to gather your forces to produce the male child the mare wants, or mayhap just to ride along the drop and gather the last flowers of your maidenhood. Do you understand?"
"Yes." She dropped a curtsy. "Thank you, Sai."
Rhea waved this off as if it were a flattery.
"Speak not of what passed between us, mind. 'Tis no one's affair but our own."
"I won't. And our business is done?"
"Well, mayhap there's one more small thing."
Rhea smiled to show it was indeed small, then raised her left hand in front of Susan's eyes, with 3 fingers together and 1 apart. Glimmering in the fork between was a silver medallion, seemingly produced from nowhere. The girl's eyes fastened on it at once. Until Rhea spoke a single guttural word, that was. Then they closed. Five. Rhea looked at the girl who stood asleep on her stoop in the moonlight. As she replaced the medallion within her sleeve, her fingers were old and bunchy, but they moved dexterously enough when it was required. Oh, aye, the business-like expression fell from her face and was replaced by a look of squint-eyed fury.
"Kick me into the fire, would you, you trull? Tattle to Thorin?"
But her threats and impudence weren't the worst. The worst had been the expression of revulsion on her face when she had pulled back from Rhea's touch. Too good for Rhea, she was, and thought herself too good for Thorin as well, no doubt. She was 16 years worth of fine blonde hair hanging down from her head, hair Thorin no doubt dreamed of plunging his hands into, even as he plunged and reared and plowed down below. She couldn't hurt the girl, much as she wanted to and much as the girl deserved it. If nothing else, Thorin might take the glass ball away from her, and Rhea couldn't bear that, not yet anyway. So she could not hurt the girl. But she could do something that would spoil his pleasure in her, at least for a while. Rhea leaned close to the girl, grasped the long braid which lay down her back, and began to slip it through her fist, enjoying its silky smoothness.
"Susan," she whispered. "Do you hear me, Susan, daughter of Patrick?"
"Yes."
The eyes did not open.
"Then listen."
The light of the kissing moon fell on Rhea's face and turned it into a silver skull.
"Listen to me well, and remember. Remember in the deep cave where your waking mind never goes."
She pulled the braid through her hand again and again.
silky and smooth, like the little bud between her legs.
"Remember," the girl in the doorway said.
"Aye, there's something ye'll do after he takes your virginity. You'll do it right away without even thinking about it. Now listen to me, Susan, daughter of Patrick, and hear me very well."
Still stroking the girl's hair, Rhea put her wrinkled lips to the smooth cup of Susan's ear and whispered in the moonlight.
Chapter 3. A Meeting on the Road. 1. She had never in her life had such a strange night, and it was probably not surprising that she didn't hear the rider approaching from behind until he was almost upon her. The thing that troubled her most as she made her way back toward town was her new understanding of the compact she had made. It was good to have a reprieve, months yet before she would have to live up to her end of the bargain. But a reprieve didn't change the basic fact. When the demon moon was full, she would lose her virginity to Mayor Thorin, a skinny, twitchy man with fluffy white hair rising like a cloud around the bald spot on top of his head, a man whose wife regarded him with a certain weary sadness that was painful to look at. Hart Thorin was a man who laughed uproariously when a company of players put on an entertainment involving head-knocking or pretend-punching or rotten fruit-throwing, but who only looked puzzled at a story which was pathetic or tragical. A knuckle-cracker, a back-slapper, a dinner-table belcher, a man who had a way of looking anxiously toward his chancellor at almost every other word, as if to make sure he hadn't offended Rhymer in some way. Susan had observed all these things often. Her father had for years been in charge of the barony's horse and had gone to Seafront often on business. Many times he had taken his much-loved daughter with him. Oh, she had seen a lot of Hart Thorin over the years, and he had seen a lot of her as well. Too much, mayhap. For what now seemed the most important fact about him was that he was almost 50 years older than the girl who would perhaps bear his son. She had made the bargain lightly enough. No, not lightly, that was being unfair to herself. But she had lost little sleep over it, that much was true. She had thought, after listening to all Aunt Cord's arguments, "Well, it's little enough, really, to have the indenture off the lands, to finally own our little piece of the drop, in fact as well as in tradition, to actually have papers, one in our house and one in Rhymer's files, saying it's ours." Aye, and to have horses again. Only 3, 'tis true, but that's 3 more than we have now. And against that, to lie with him a time or two, and to bear a child, which millions of women have done before me with no harm. 'Tis not, after all, a mutant or a leper I'm being asked to partner with, but just an old man with noisy knuckles. 'Tis not forever, and as Aunt Cord says, I may still marry, if time and Ka decree. I should not be the first woman to come to her husband's bed as a mother. And does it make me a whore to do such? The law says not. But never mind that. My heart's law is what matters. And my heart says that if I may gain the land that was my dad's, and 3 horses to run on it by being such, then it's a whore I'll be." There was something else. Aunt Cord had capitalized rather ruthlessly, Susan now saw, on a child's innocence. It was the baby, Aunt Cord had harped on, the cunning little baby she would have. Aunt Cord had known that Susan, the dolls of her childhood put aside not all that long ago, would love the idea of her own baby, a little living doll to dress and feed and sleep with in the heat of the afternoon. What Cordelia had ignored, perhaps she's too innocent even to have considered it, Susan thought, but didn't quite believe, was what the hag woman had made brutally clear to her this evening. Thorin wanted more than a child.
"He wants tits and ass that don't squish in his hands, and a box that'll grip when he pushes."
Just thinking of those words made her face throb as she walked through the post-moonset dark toward town. No high-spirited running this time, no singing either. She had agreed with vague thoughts of how managed livestock mated. They were allowed to go at it until the seed took, then separated again. But now she knew that Thorin might want her again and again, probably would want her again and again, and common law going back like iron for 200 generations said that he could continue to lie with her until she who had proved the consort honest should prove her honestly with child as well. And that child honest in and of itself, not that was a mutant aberration. Susan had made discreet inquiries and knew that this second proving usually came around the fourth month of pregnancy, around the time she would begin to show, even with her clothes on. It would be up to Rhea to make the judgment, and Rhea didn't like her. Now that it was too late, now that she had accepted the compact formally tendered by the Chancellor, now that she had been proved honest by yon strange bitch, she rued the bargain. Mostly what she thought of was how Thorin would look with his pants off, his legs white and skinny like the legs of a stork, and how as they lay together she would hear his long bones crackling, knees and back and elbows and neck. And knuckles, don't forget his knuckles. Yes, big old man's knuckles with hair growing out of them. Susan chuckled at the thought, it was that comical. But at the same time, a warm tear ran unnoticed from the corner of one eye and tracked down her cheek. She wiped it away without knowing it, any more than she heard the clip-clop of approaching hoofs in the soft road dust. Her mind was still far away, returning to the odd thing she had seen through the old woman's bedroom window. The soft but somehow unpleasant light coming from the pink globe, the hypnotized way the hag had been looking down at it. When Susan at last heard the approaching horse, her first alarmed thought was that she must get into the copse of trees she was currently passing and hide. The chances of anyone above board being on the road this late seemed small to her, especially now that such bad times had come to Midworld. But it was too late for that. The ditch, then, and sprawled flat. With the moon down, there was at least a chance that whoever it was would pass without... But before she could even begin in that direction, the rider who had sneaked up behind her while she was thinking her long and rueful thoughts had hailed her. "Good even, lady, and may your days be long upon the earth." She turned, thinking, what if it's one of the new men always lounging about Mayor's house or in the Traveler's Rest? Not the oldest one, the voice isn't wavery like his, but maybe one of the others. It could be the one they called the Pape. "Good even," she heard herself saying to the man-shape on the tall horse, "may yours be long also." Her voice didn't tremble, not that she could hear. She didn't think it was Deep Pape, or the one named Reynolds, either. The only thing she could tell about the fellow for sure was that he wore a flat-brimmed hat, the sort she associated with men of the inner baronies, back when travel between east and west had been more common than it was now. Back before John Farson came, the good man, and the bloodletting began. As the stranger came up beside her, she forgave herself a little for not hearing him approach. There was no buckle or bell on his gear that she could see, and everything was tied down so as not to snap or flap. It was almost the rig of an outlaw or a harrier. She had the idea that Jonas, he of the wavery voice, and his two friends might have been both in other times and other climes, or even a gunslinger. But this man bore no guns, unless they were hidden. A bow on the pommel of his saddle, and what looked like a lance in a scabbard, that was all. And there had never, she reckoned, been a gunslinger as young as this. He clucked side-mouth at the horse, just as her dad had always done, and she herself, of course, and it stopped at once. As he swung one leg over his saddle, lifting it high and with unconscious grace, Susan said, "Nay, nay, don't trouble yourself, stranger, but go as you would." If he heard the alarm in her voice, he paid no heed to it. He slipped off the horse, not bothering with the tied-down stirrup, and landed neatly in front of her, the dust of the road puffing about his square-toed boots. By starlight she saw that he was young indeed, close to her own age, on one side or the other. His clothes were those of a working cowboy, although new. "Will Dearborn at your service," he said, then doffed his hat, extended a foot on one boot heel, and bowed as they did in the inner baronies. Such absurd courtliness out here in the middle of nowhere, with the acrid smell of the oil patch on the edge of town already in her nostrils, startled her out of her fear and into a laugh. She thought it would likely offend him, but he smiled instead. A good smile, honest and artless, its inner part lined with even teeth. She dropped him a little curtsy, holding out one side of her dress. "Susan Delgado, at yours."